Well, welcome to Brettonomics, a podcast series brought to you by the Bretton Woods Committee. I'm Nancy Jacklin, and I'm hosting this series about the institutions created for cooperation in international monetary and economic affairs. During this segment of the series, we've been discussing institutions created for international cooperation and economic development, starting with the World Bank, which, as you know, was created at the historic Bretton Woods Conference in 1944. Last time, we moved on to a discussion of three regional development banks patterned in many ways on the World Bank in their structure and governance, but with a regional, not a global scope: the Inter-American Development Bank, the African Development Bank, and the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Well, we're going to continue today with a look at the last of these so-called legacy RDBs, the Asian Development Bank. I thought it useful to consider its creation and evolution as part of a discussion also of the creation of the two newest multilateral development banks, both of which became operational in 2016. The new development bank, started by Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, often called the BRICS Bank, and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. China played an important role in the creation of both, and global and regional politics have had a substantial influence in the creation and evolution of all three institutions. So I thought it might be useful to look at them in a single podcast. My guest today is Takatoshi Kato, who has had a distinguished career in international financial policy, having held a series of senior positions at the Ministry of Finance of Japan, including as Vice Minister for International Affairs. Takatoshi has served in a number of senior positions in the international institutions we're discussing in these podcasts. He was a deputy managing director of the IMF from 2004 to 2010, when I had the pleasure of working with him. And relevant to our discussion today, he has served as the executive director for Japan at the Asian Development Bank and is currently on the International Advisory Board of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. In addition, Takatoshi has been the president of the Japan Center for International Finance and continues to serve as an advisor to the current president. So our guest is clearly bringing to our podcast a deep experience in the issues of international finance and development in the Asian region and the institutions that foster cooperation. So welcome, Taka.
Thank you for your kind introduction, Nancy. I'm very happy to take part in this podcast series.
That's terrific. Well, let's dig right in and start talking about the Asian Development Bank. It was created in 1966 at a time when the Asia Pacific was the poorest region in the world. So tell us, who were the initial members of the ADB?
In 1966, the ADB started its operation with 31 original members, of which 19 were regional members and 12 were non-regional, i.e. North America and European members. Preparatory work was undertaken largely in Bangkok and headed by the top of the United Nations Economic Commission for Asia and the Far East. The location of ADB headquarters was competed fiercely among Tokyo, Manila, and Tehran. All these episodes indicate that there was a strong sense of ownership in establishing the ADB among interested Asians.
Yeah, in Japan, I guess the one advanced industrialized country that had a lot to gain from growth of the economies in its neighborhood was very keen on having a regional development bank, knowing the financing needs of the region were enormous, including the need for basic infrastructure financing. It took a while, I guess, for the Southeast Asian countries and for the United States to support its creation, but finally it happened and we got an ADB. At that time, it was said that development in Asia followed a kind of leader and the geese pattern. Can you explain that and how it affected the formation and early activities of the bank?
Yes. The first ADB president, Mr. Watanabe, commented the ADB as an institution aiming at something akin to the so-called family doctor, as against general hospital type of the Bretton Woods World Bank Group. In the late 1960s, Asia was believed to be at an early stage of so-called flying geese pattern of development, namely Japan at the top, followed by four tigers, Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, and Hong Kong, and other ASEAN. ASEAN means Association of Southeast Asian Nation Countries, at the very nascent stage of economic development. In the third law of flying geese, so to speak. Incidentally, China was, People's Republic of China, was on the other side of Iron Curtain in that period.
Yeah. I'd also note that Japan continues to play a very important leadership role in the ADB as the largest shareholder, and with the ADB president customarily being from Japan. Now, the ADB, I guess, looked very much in its financial model and its authorized activities like the World Bank and did many of the same things, but for the regional membership. Its activities, in particular, who the recipients of its support would be, when I was reading about this, was very much shaped by the politics of the region and to some degree by politics with the World Bank. Can you tell us about that, Taka?
In terms of governance structure and funding, ADB was modeled after the World Bank Group, to be sure. But in order to safeguard the regional character, ADB charter requires that more than 60% of voting share must be held by the regional members, namely members of the United Nations Economic Commission for Asia. That stretches from the South Pacific to West Asia, such as Afghanistan or Iraq.
Yeah, so it's much broader than what we normally think of as Asia. Now, tell me a bit about the membership of China.
The Republic of China, a formal name for Taiwan, was founding member of the ADB. Different from the Bretton Woods institutions, membership issue of the People's Republic of China at the ADB was treated as a question of new membership. I can recall, because I was the executive director representing Japan at that time. In 1986, the ADB consumed a significant amount of resources and energies to make it sure that both of the People's Republic of China and Taipei is an ADB membership name for the Republic of China remained as a members of the ADB.
Yeah, the contrast is fascinating. I mean, the contrast with the IMF and World Bank, and where China was in fact a founding member in each institution in 1945. However, because of global politics, the authorities in Taiwan, the Republic of China, represented the member China in those bodies from 1949 until April of 1980, when the PRC was recognized internationally as the government of China. But as you said, when the ADB was formed in 1966, that recognition had not yet occurred. And therefore, with that recognition in the 1980s, the issue for the ADB was one of making the PRC a new member, not one of taking up the representation of a prior member, as was true in the IMF and the World Bank. I'd also note that also due to this historical circumstance, Hong Kong, China, is also a separate member, and certainly at the time it was considered very much sort of a British entity. Another interesting dimension of global politics affected the role of the ADB in the early years in development lending to India. Can you tell us about that?
A kind of division of labor with the World Bank was observed in early stage of the operation of the ADB. One example was lending to India. India's potential borrowing needs seemed so large that lending to India was thought better handled by the World Bank Group. The ADB's lending to India started only in 1986.
Yeah, that's a long time. That's a couple of decades. Another interesting aspect of how sort of international politics affected the ADB's lending activities is that there were no loans to the Mekong Delta countries until the end of the Vietnam War and of the Cold War in the 1990s. Now, when we look at the evolution of the region over time, economic development in Asia from the 1960s to the 1990s was really impressive, wasn't it?
Yes. Compared to other regions, economic development in the East Asian region was so impressive that the World Bank published in 1993 a book on its diagnosis of East Asian economic development titled The East Asian Economic Miracle.
Yeah, well, the economic miracle, we learned in one of our earlier podcasts about the Asian financial crisis in the late 1990s. And it was really a shock and wake-up call in that the assumptions by both the international private sector and the public sector about the Asian tigers and their growth miracle were missing some real vulnerabilities. However, the IMF supported economic adjustment programs to address the imbalances that we discussed in our earlier podcast. Turned out to be very controversial, in fact, and led to some deep resentment among many of the Asian members. Can you tell us what the core of the concerns were, Taka?
Yeah. I'm speaking mainly from the standpoint of Asians.
Yes.
1997-98 Asian monetary crisis was indeed a crisis of confidence in the East Asian countries. On one hand, there was a sense that corruption and poor governance was at the root cause of the crisis. There was, however, other quarters that felt capital flight was caused by too hasty liberalization of capital account among affected East Asian countries. In the two of the three IMF program countries, incumbent governments were replaced. In the midst of confusion and chaos, a sense that Western countries were employing the IMF without themselves financially contributing to assist Asian countries in distress, to impose conditionalities not directly connected to putting out fire on the house, so to speak. One picture still in the minds of East Asian policymakers is the one that shows the then managing director of the IMF, Michel Kamdoutsou, standing with his arms crossed behind the Indonesian president's house signing the IMF loan document.
Yes, I often thought that the managing director in that photograph on the front page of the Financial Times looked like the Lord High Executioner. I think the Asian countries also saw a fairly stark comparison between how the Asian financial crisis was handled and that of Mexico in 1994, when the U.S. and the IMF put together a $50 billion rescue package quickly to address what was viewed as a capital flight crisis, with the IMF program having pretty standard conditionality and certainly much less stringent than what was in a lot of the Asian programs. So speaking of that crisis in the late 1990s, can you tell us what role the ADB played in helping members get through it?
ADB played a great role. As we know, the IMF was at the center of organizing financial packages of scale credible to the market. Together with the World Bank, as well as bilateral contributors such as Japan and Australia, the ADB provided a significant amount of loans, in particular in the form of program loans to finance budget deficits of affected Asian countries.
Well, the Asia-Pacific region countries also looked at a few new ways to be more self-sufficient as a region in the event of future financing needs, setting up the ASEAN Plus 3 group, as you mentioned, and the Chiang Mai Initiative to meet short-term liquidity needs of the Asian members. And Japan was very much at the forefront of those efforts. Can you tell us what the purposes of these were to be?
In 1997-98, the Asian financial crisis, Japan played a similar role to that of the United States at the time of 94-95 Mexican financial crisis. I handled the so-called Tsubonos crisis at the Japanese end as the head of International Finance Bureau. And in 1997, I handled the early stage of the Thai crisis as vice minister. But as the risk of contagion became very real among East Asian countries, Japan became conscious of limitation associated with ad hoc firefighting approach. Thus, Japan floated unofficially an idea of creating an Asian Monetary Fund. At the time of 1997 IMF World Bank annual meetings in Hong Kong. But that approach didn't gain sufficient traction. In 1997, the ASEAN summit invited three countries, Japan, China, and Korea, for consultation. That was the start of ASEAN Plus 3 framework of meetings. Subsequently, in the year 2000, ASEAN Plus 3 group agreed at the time of ADB annual meetings held at the Chiang Mai, Thailand, to create a network of bilateral swap arrangements, later to be called as Chiang Mai Initiative, in order to dissipate concern against duplicating conditionalities. A great portion of swap arrangement is expected to be activated in tandem with the corresponding IMF program.
Yeah, so these swap lines, the Chiang Mai Initiative swap lines, were a way to have, I guess, on standby, more liquidity support ready, especially to meet a capital flight crisis. Was the ADB involved in any of these efforts for greater regional monetary and financial independence?
The ADB provided technical analysis work for the ASEAN Plus 3 meetings alongside with the IMF. Many of ASEAN Plus 3 initiatives were announced in the margin of ADB-related events. Subsequently, creation of ASEAN Plus 3 Macro Research Office, AMRO for short, Asia-based macroeconomic research arm for the ASEAN Plus 3 meetings, was agreed in 2009, and AMRO, based in Singapore, became an international institution in 2016.
Yeah, and AMRO, I guess, absorbed the swap line facility, the Chiang Mai facility. And also, as you said, that they were doing economic analysis and started producing country reports along the lines of the IMF Article 4 reports for countries in the region. So it's quite an important institution now for Asian cooperation. Now, one of the more pressing issues today, and I've raised it in a number of our podcasts on the MDBs, is the potential threat from climate change to economic development. We've spoken in those other podcasts about what each one is doing in this area to address mitigation of greenhouse gases and to provide for resilience in the face of climate-related damage and disasters. Asia and the Pacific are responsible for more than half of all global carbon emissions, and many of the poorest countries in the region are most at risk of the growing threats of climate change, such as natural disasters and sea level rise. What part is the ADB committed to play in addressing these challenges, Taka?
The ADB is aiming at becoming the climate bank for Asia and the Pacific region, so to speak. For this purpose, the ADB intends to provide $100 billion in cumulative climate financing from its ADB's own resources in the years 2019 to 2030. Among innovative facilities and instruments ADB has developed, one is Energy Transition Mechanism, through which the ADB, in partnership with such countries as Philippines or Indonesia, tries to accelerate the phasing out of coal-fired power generation. Another innovative instrument ADB has developed is Innovative Financing Facility for Climate in Asia and the Pacific. This instrument aims at guaranteeing some of the ADB loans and shoulder losses in case of ADB's borrowers' default by way of financial commitment on the part of donor countries such as the United Kingdom, United States, Japan, and South Korea, and so on.
Yeah, it's a way of really expanding the ADB's balance sheet by getting these external guarantees of loans that it can sell off. So it's a way of increasing the volume of its engagement.
You're going to create extra margin for the ADB loan envelope.
Yep. Well, now let's move on to some of the newer institutions and talk about the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the New Development Bank. China was an instigator of each of those, as you said, India more so on the New Development Bank. And they both became fully operational in 2016, but they're really quite different from each other. Each does borrow the basic financial model of the World Bank and the legacy MDBs. Let's talk about what was the motivation to create them and what each is intended to do in the realm of economic development. So first, we'll discuss the larger and more important of the two newest MDBs, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. It clearly is led by China. It's headquartered in that country and with China, the largest shareholder, and a Chinese official as its president. Can you tell us why it was created and what is its membership?
As China's political and economic weight rose impressively to the extent only next to the United States, China is said to contemplate creating an alternative to the Bretton Woods institutions. President Xi Jinping made public in 2013 the Belt and Road Initiatives. In 2012, India floated an idea of creating an MDB by the BRICS countries. As to the infrastructure investment needs in Asia, ADB estimated for the decade of 2010 to 2020, there would be $8 trillion worth of infrastructure investment need in Asia. Against this background, President Xi proposed in 2013 establishing the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. The AIIB started its operation in 2016, that is 50 years later from the creation of the ADB, with 57 initial members.
And then what were the, there's certainly a fair amount of controversy when it was created and then a little bit over the years. What were the principal political controversies when it was established and some of the more recent ones?
The question of whether any of G7 donor countries, in addition to their ADB membership, would join the AIIB had become a hotly debated political issue. It was reported that despite misgivings of the Obama administration, the United Kingdom took an initiative of becoming AIIB member, with other European countries immediately following the UK step. Thus, the United States and Japan are the only two G7 countries that chose not to join the AIIB. Indeed, currently AIIB's membership expanded to 109, much larger than ADB's 68 members. More recently, like other MDBs and IMF, the AIIB's interaction with Russia was put on hold following Russian invasion into Ukraine in 2022. More recently, in June last year, one Canadian senior staff, in departing the AIIB, accused the AIIB for being dominated by the Chinese Communist Party, an accusation, in my view, yet to be substantiated.
Yeah. Well, so clearly there's been some political tension about the AIIB from time to time. And I think the motivations of China in creating the AIIB with itself in the leadership role generated concerns that it was seeking to challenge the established world economic order, which had at its core the Bretton Woods institutions. But we'll talk a bit later on just how that's played out. So, let's talk about the AIIB's operations. How does the size of the AIIB compare to the World Bank and to the ADB?
For the year 2023, the AIIB's loan approval amounted to $6.8 billion, as against the ADB's $20.2 billion, or World Bank's excluding the IDA, $38.6 billion. In terms of staff size, AIIB's 500 plus is much smaller than the ADB's 3,800 or the World Bank Group's well above 10,000.
Well, that's quite some differences. So how are its financial activities different from or the same as those of the other MDBs working in the region?
The AIIB has been conservatively managed with its AAA rating secured from three rating agencies. The AIIB's financial activities are similar to those of the ADB or the World Bank. While lacking in soft loan windows like the IDA or ADB's ADF, as well as network of field offices, AIIB's Corporate Strategy 2030 aims at securing private sector financing 50% of total financing by the year 2030, and climate financing 50% of total AIIB financing by year 2025.
Like the other MDBs, the AIIB can lend to any member government or to any governmental subdivision or even to private entities, but only like the other MDBs, but only with the backing of the national government. To what extent is China a borrower from the AIIB?
China borrowed from the AIIB, but up to now, the AIIB's lending to China is largely limited to climate or health-related loan, while India is a more significant borrower from the AIIB.
And to what extent is the AIIB cooperating with the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank in Asia in terms of shared projects or division of labor, so to speak? To what extent is it co-financing or collaborating with the other MDBs?
Developing countries' borrowing needs from the MDBs are so large that more recently MDBs are positioned to cooperate with each other, as advised by the G20 countries. The AIIB in particular has been eager to conduct co-financing with other MDBs, most notably with the World Bank and ADB, particularly in the area of program loan or blended financing.
And then, I mean, we've now talked about these two important institutions, one with quite a long history, and then the AIIB more recently, and some of the tensions. But how's the Asia region, apart from China, looking today at its relationships with the IMF, the World Bank, the ADB, and the AIIB? Is there a clear preference for regional institutions, or are there some doubts or concerns about each of them in terms of a true alignment of interests?
The ASEAN region, in my view, is realistic enough to turn first to the Bretton Woods institutions to address crises of global significance, like Great Financial Crisis of 2008-2009 or COVID-19 crisis. As regards more conventional loan demand, the Asian region turned to both World Bank or regional MDB in Asia, like ADB and AIIB. As regards surveillance discussion in the ASEAN Plus 3 framework, presentation by AMROS staff is said to precede that of IMF staff. This is because, I would imagine, ASEAN policymakers have a sense that research by the AMROS is closer to clients, so to speak, than that of the IMF staff.
Yeah. I think in comparing institutions, I should note that the ADB has been very collaborative, efficient, and an effective institution and has a really high reputation. It has agreements also with all of the other MDBs on cooperation and knowledge sharing. I think what what the series is showing us is that it's important with the proliferation of regional development banks and new development banks that the core of global cooperation and economic development is maintained somehow for mutual benefit. So let me talk about the other newest of the multilateral development banks, the New Development Bank. It has about half the capital of the IIB and is quite different, in fact. It had only five founding members, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. It's referred to as the BRICS Bank because of the first initials of each of those country names. And because it was those five countries were labeled as the BRICS by a banker at Goldman Sachs who viewed the state of their economies and financial markets as kind of similar so as to group them as a class of assets for investing. I must say that seemed to me a rather odd rationale for creating a new institution, but, you know, what do I know? Its membership is, in fact, open to any UN member. But the founders are to maintain majority control of the institution. Only a few additional countries have joined so far: Bangladesh, the UAE, and Egypt. Uruguay is a prospective member. Like the legacy MDBs, the BRICS Bank has paid in and callable capital and funds itself in the markets, but its bond rating is a notch below that of the AIIB, and thus the loans will have to carry a higher interest rate. Its loan portfolio is also more concentrated than that of the AIIB, with loans principally outstanding to India, China, and Brazil. Both institutions make infrastructure loans, so far principally in the energy and transportation sectors, and largely to public, not private sector borrowers. As I mentioned earlier, there was and still remains a concern by some that the creation of these two new MDBs is motivated by a desire to undermine the established international economic order. But creating the two institutions can also be viewed as having a political and practical motivation in at least several respects. First, there was clearly a level of frustration for many of the growing non-advanced economies to have a greater voice and vote in the multilateral financial institutions. The BRICS share of global GDP had grown from 16% in 1992 to 31% in 2020, but its combined voting share in the World Bank, for example, only grew from 11% to 13.5% in that period. So I guess they thought, why not establish one or more alternative institutions where one had a larger voice? And this is not unlike some of the motivations for the creation of the legacy RDBs. Second, there was a frustration among borrowers from the legacy MDBs with the administrative delays and hurdles and the conditionality in some of the lending activities of those institutions, and a desire to make them more streamlined and perhaps more sympathetic to borrower perspectives. And finally, as you said, there was a perceived need for more infrastructure investment and a desire to prioritize funding for those projects. So each of these two new institutions have addressed those concerns in somewhat different ways, with the AIIB pursuing lending standards closer to those of the World Bank and also collaborating more closely with the World Bank and ADB where it can be mutually productive. The NDB is a bit more at odds with the traditional lenders and more sympathetic to the complaints of borrowers and a little less internationally collaborative. Well, this concludes our two podcasts on the Regional Development Bank. So I want to thank you, Takatoshi, for a wonderful exploration of the role of the multilateral development banks in Asia, as well as the evolution of the political dynamics at play, both in their operation and in the creation of some newer institutions. We can see from the series of podcasts on the MDBs that the concept of economic development has changed over the years, as has the role that outside institutions can best play in that process, and that this role and the mechanisms for cooperation continue to evolve. Next time, we'll be discussing the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which has its origins in the Marshall Plan for Europe. As with all the other institutions we've talked about in this series, the OECD evolved a lot over the years, and today plays a rather unique role as an institution for international economic cooperation. We hope you continue with us on this journey, and please feel free to give us your feedback on the series and share its availability with others you think may be interested in listening and learning as well. Thank you again, Taka. I've really enjoyed it.